God has an indictment, a legal accusation against the people. They are in deep trouble. We think about the question that the Apostle Paul once wrote to the Romans. If God be for us, who can be against us? And see these people centuries before in exactly the opposite position and left to wonder, if God is against us, what happens next? Well, what happens next? God gives details, and so we continue to read. O my people, what have I done to you? How have I wearied you? Answer me. For I brought you up from the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery, and I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. This is the story that we spent from September to December looking at, how God brought them up out of slavery in Egypt and brought them to the promised land through the leadership of Moses and his siblings, Aaron and Miriam. God had done great things for them. You think that they would live forever after in relief and response to his goodness, but it wasn't like that. And what we have here in God's indictment is the fact that the people, centuries later, about seven centuries after they got into the promised land, were giving their great God the impression that it's sort of a tiring thing to be his people. So that God asks the question, what have I done to you? How have I wearied you? For the people acted as if they were weary of God. And whatever happened when Micah delivered the message, Micah himself took the indictment personally and started asking himself some good questions. So we read on. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? This is the question Micah was asking. And then he thinks about what he might bring to God in response to God's accusation to make amends, to repair the relationship damage that he was responsible for. He thinks about all the offerings and sacrifices that are commanded in the law, in the covenant, and asks, shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil? He thinks about taking the Word of God really strictly and offering all the sacrifices that were encouraged and instructed to be given. And then he sort of freestyles beyond that and thinks, what if I go way beyond the law? What if I give even more than the law demands? He says, shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He thinks, what if I sacrifice my child to God? Would that in any way, repair the damage of the relationship? And maybe because Micah had gone to such lengths in his questioning, maybe because he had imagined actually sacrificing his child, something which other religions frequently practice, but which was strictly forbidden under the covenant that these people were in, an answer comes from God, very matter-of-factly, about what it is we should give to him to repair the damage in our relationship to him, to repair the impression, to correct the impression that we are tired of God. So here's the text that we are looking at specifically this morning. Verse 8. He has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you, but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. So we can summarize these eight verses this way. In response to God's shocking indictment, a people who have apparently become tired of God are told what God thinks is good. And in fact, it's a reminder. He has already told you, O man, what is good. It's a reminder of three things that the Lord requires of human beings. And I thought this would be a good way for us to end the year with the new year approaching. So here's a three-point list, what the Lord requires of human beings. And I'll make fast work of the first 2 points and get to the third, which is the one I want to talk to you about practically this morning. So, what the Lord requires of human beings, number one, to do justice. This is just reading verse 8. To do justice, which is to do the righteous thing, to do the right thing. And it's worth noting, as we proceed, that there is such a thing as the right thing. We see in Psalm 89, for example, what we see all the way through the Bible, there's such a thing as righteousness, there's such a thing as justice. It says in Psalm 89, righteousness and justice are the foundation of God's throne. His reign over the world is based upon the foundation of his throne is righteousness and justice. This is the strength of the Judeo-Christian religions. This is the strength of biblical thought about God, that there's such an absolute as righteousness and justice. And just briefly to touch on this before I move on, what we need to see is that the commitment that we are required to show to justice has both an individual and a collective or a group implication. So in regard to our personal obligations to do justice, to be righteous people, I'm happy to remind you or to announce that starting next week, January 3rd, we will spend 11 of the weeks between New Year's and Easter looking at the Ten Commandments and seeing it as a summary or a delineation of the personal obligations we have to do the right thing, to do justice, to do righteousness. But we don't just have a individual responsibility to be just people. We have a collective responsibility and collectively are able to accomplish more in a society and in the world than we can individually, although the two overlap. And so in that regard, and in view of our collective responsibility to do the just thing, to do justice, I'm happy to announce what I think is already in the bulletin, that on Sunday, February 21st, we will give a whole lot of the morning services to the International Justice Mission, an organization headquartered in Canada here in London that has a whole lot of work to do in terms of bringing freedom to slaves and liberation from all kinds of injustice to people, particularly in Southeast Asia and Africa. And we'll hear about that on February 21st, a way of looking squarely at the opportunities we have to do justice globally as a church family. That's one thing, do justice. The second thing that the Lord requires of human beings, it's right there in verse 8, is to love kindness, to be a person whose life demonstrates a love for kindness. And that shouldn't require a great deal of explanation. All through the Scriptures, we read of the fact that love is the thing. For example, in Paul's personal letter to Timothy in the New Testament, Paul says that this matter-of-factly, the aim of our charge or the goal of our instruction or what we're after in regard to everything we're doing for people, the aim of our charge is love. But love that issues from a pure heart and a good conscience and a sincere faith, this is the goal of our work with people. This is the net effect that we hope for in regard to all that we do for people. And what I'd like you to think about in terms of the first two points of this list, to do justice and love kindness, is that we see in that, really, the whole point, the major themes of human history. The Bible shows that the whole of human history, you know, the play that God is staging on the stage that is the world, in the theater that is the universe, is God's justice and God's kindness. We see that over and over again in Scripture, that these two things, the justice of God and the kindness of God, are what human history is all about. For example, in Romans 11, when Paul is writing a summary of the gospel and gets to the whole point of what he's been doing and is doing for Israel, he says in verse 22, "Note then the kindness and the severity of God. The kindness is love and compassion. The severity is justice and wrath." This is what the world is about. So it makes sense, I think, as we look at a three-point list of what the Lord requires of us all, that the first two points would have everything to do with what the whole universe is about. What God requires of us is what the whole universe is about, to be on the side of justice, to be on the side of kindness. Those two themes run throughout human history. But there's a third thing, and it's the one I want us to focus on most closely this morning. And the one more thing that's left on this three-point list of what the Lord requires is not just the whole point of human history, but the whole point of your life, the whole point of a particular history, a particular human story. The major theme of life, the major theme especially of eternal life, the Bible speaks of it that way, is this number three requirement to walk humbly with your God. And what I want to talk to you about this morning as we think about 2010 is what 2010 would be like if you took gave more strict attention and gave more time and effort to this particular requirement of the Lord to walk humbly with your God. So let's think about that this morning. To walk humbly with your God is, I hope you see, a figure of speech. It really doesn't have anything to do with walking. You can do this from a wheelchair. You can do this from a sick bed. You don't have to actually be able to walk. The point is, I hope obvious, that life can be compared to a walk. It gets compared to a walk because you live your life a step at a time. That is, your life is the sum total of its component parts. 2010 will be the sort of year it will be as the sum total of all the days of 2010. You'll have about 365 of them. All of us who survived that long will have 365 component parts, that is, individual days of 2010. And what 2010 nets out to be will be the sum total of all those days. And those days have a number of waking hours, different for some of us than for others. And those hours will be made up of a whole lot of individual thoughts and actions and words, and every one is a step you take. So life can be compared to a walk because it is, in fact, the sum total of a whole lot of individual steps you take. And what we are being told to do here, figuratively, is to do each step, and so to take that walk with God. Walk humbly with your God. This is the requirement of God. So I want you to think about 2010 that way, and in your imagination, picture coming to the end of 2010 as we are coming to the end of 2009, knowing that whatever else can be said needs to be said about the year of your life that we call 2010, you can say this for yourself. This was a year that you walked with God. And I won't say much about humbly this morning, but understand, to do this would be your humility. To live your life focused on God is to give attention to God in a way that must humble you. You stop looking at yourself. You stop living with eyes set squarely on your own agenda and look to God. That's the humility with which we are to spend the days of our lives, one step at a time. To walk humbly with your God, then, is to live your life, for example, the part of your life we'll call 2010, with a moment-by-moment consciousness that God is your God, and that your heart is beating, and your lungs are functioning, and all the complexities of your physical being are continuing to result in you being alive by the active work of God. In Him we live and move and have our being. And in the Bible, the word godliness means that sort of consciousness, that sort of awareness. Godliness could be translated Godwardness. And the instruction here, the requirement, is to live in a Godward way, to live with a focus on God so that every step you take, every thought you think, as much as you're in control of your thoughts, everything you choose to say rather than just opening your mouth and letting everybody see what comes out, every decision you make would be made in a Godward way, would be made in view of the fact that you know you are the product of God's creativity and your life continues because God sustains it. So we're talking about 2010 with a focus on God. And I wonder if the idea of living that sort of life interests you. That's the question I'd ask you if you took me out to coffee today. You probably don't want to do that. I'd look you right in the eye and say, so by the way, you were in church today. I was talking away. Does the idea of devoting a whole year of your life to God interest you? And you know, I think that some of us, if asked that question, I've asked myself this week the question of, I had to answer that question if somebody took me to coffee and asked me that question. In actual fact, some of us would have to say, the idea wearies me. I'm a little tired of the Christian thing. Been at it a long time and it's not, I mean, how would you say, I'm making this up. I've been at it a long time and it just doesn't thrill me the way I thought it would. That is easily an answer that some might give to the question of whether or not walking humbly with your God is of interest to you for 2010. And maybe you're a pragmatic sort who would say, but I'd be glad to have my mind changed. Give me some perspective. What should be my motivation? Why should I be interested rather than wearied at the thought of walking a whole year with God? And I'd be good for an answer or two to that. I'd say, well, from an experiential perspective, what walking with God has to offer you has everything to do with the fact that when we're talking about God, we're talking about the being who is the source of life in every sense. The source of physical life, you're only alive because He keeps you alive. Source of spiritual life. Source of qualitative life, a life that's worth living. You don't want to live more than just survive. Everything that makes life really worth living is a gift of God. God invented peace of mind. God invented joy. God invented love. These are His inventions. He's the source of all these things. So what? You want to live a year without peace, without joy, without love? That's what you're talking about if you tear yourself away from God and He lets you go, because He is the source of peace and joy and love. Wherever these human experiences are experienced, God is at work. So from an experiential perspective, there's lots of reason to be interested rather than wearied at the thought of living for God. And then from a moral perspective, It's just a matter of doing the right thing. So when you ask, why should I be interested in walking with God? I say, well, you know, because you should be interested in doing the right thing. And it is the right thing. For life is a gift that God has given you. And He doesn't give it without strings attached. He doesn't give it without purposes. Everything has a purpose in life, including you. And the purpose of your life is to know God and to walk with Him. So it should be of some interest to you. So this is the challenge, to take to heart the requirements of God. It's not a long list. It's a totally reasonable list. On the one hand, there's doing justice and loving kindness. That is, get on board with the major themes of human history and be a good guy. Stand for justice and kindness. And the third thing is just fulfill your destiny. Be the person that God keeps you alive to be. That's the challenge. But I'd like to be practically helpful to you this morning. So let's think about the fact that though the walk with God that Micah is calling for has everything to do with every detail of your life, taking steps one at a time through life. On the other hand, to be really Godward, to be a person whose focus really is on God, it helps to specifically devote a certain amount of time from time to time, maybe on a regular daily basis, it helps to spend a certain amount of time working on that focus. Like if you have any other relationship with a conscious being that matters to you. You do life together, you know, with the people that you share a house with, the person you're married to or something. You do life together. All kinds of stuff just happens step by step. But you better spend some time focusing on each other. You better sit down and look into each other's eyes and ask questions and wait for answers. You got to focus on each other to really stay connected. And so we need times of focus upon God in order to stay connected on Him, to Him. So what I'm suggesting you do to help you to walk humbly with God in 2010 is plan in 2010 to devote in a specific way some time on a regular basis, maybe practically every day, spending time with God. I'm talking today about the discipline of time with God. And to do that, let me take you back in my own personal experience to the olden days, to a long, long time ago, to 1977, when my wife and I, newly married, had got our first apartment, living in Richmond Hill, corner of Center and Elizabeth Street, in a little apartment that we really, really liked. There we were. And you got to know, in order to understand what happened next, that we were both very committed to this sort of thing. From our own personal experiences and from the nature of our relationship, we had committed ourselves to being this sort of people who lived in a Godward way. We had some ideas that God had some purposes for us. We didn't have much of an idea what it would be exactly, but we had lots of ideas about what it would be about. And we settled in this apartment and took our jobs. We both had jobs in the area and thought about the future in view of the present and really wanted to get right what was going to happen next. So I had an idea for my discipleship training. I'd been a Christian for 4 years at this point. And at the ripe young age of 22, I was really determined not to, you know, start off the marriage and start off my adult life on a bad footing. I had already in mind the idea of being a guy who regularly meets with God. And I'd learned the hard way that if that doesn't happen early in the morning, it's not likely to happen at all. So I was a guy who wanted to spend time with God in the morning. That was already a given. I won't try to convince you that that's the right thing to do any more than I already have tried. Let's just assume. Let's just work with it. Here's this 22-year-old guy who just wants to get on with spending time with God every day. We lived in a cool little apartment we really liked, but there's a downside to every apartment. And one of the downsides was it had no heat control. It had no air conditioner and it had no thermostat. You just took what the vents gave you. And the vents communicated a great deal of heat from the central system of the apartment. So the apartment was stinking hot. And we just lived with that, you know, and tried to pretend we were living in Florida and make the best of it. But this fact clashed with my desire to be a guy who spends early morning time with God. I would get up at the appointed early time, and I would read the Bible, and that was okay. And then I would try to pray about what I'd read, and it was so hot that I would almost always fall asleep, which is not, you know, productive to the purpose at all. So I invented, sort of incidentally, with no idea of how helpful this was going to be, I invented the idea of going outside for a walk. I did it desperately because I was falling asleep and not fulfilling my own commitments. And there was a block that started right where our apartment was through a really picturesque part of Old Richmond Hill that I picked as my block to walk. and a block, a rectangular block, has four sides. And so I organize my praying to fit with those four sides. And this is the bright idea that I'm passing on to you many years later. I got organized in my prayer life in a way I never had before. So picture me getting up really early in the morning, and it got to be a fine science what kind of clothes to wear, depending on what time of year it was and whether the wind was blowing and all that sort of stuff. So I'd get ready to put the right kind of clothes on, and I would do my Bible reading, which I could do without drowsiness because I just got up, washed my face, and so I had, you know, like a 5 or 10 minute window. I'd do my Bible reading, and then I'd quick get out the door, and I'd start to walk. Now, I got four pieces of my praying experience because there's four sides to the block, right? And just for the sake of illustration, let me tell you how I did the walk. I walked along the first street, along Elizabeth Street, the first part of the block, and deliberately spent that time thanking God. And I did that from Philippians chapter 4 that says you should make your petitions and supplications known to God with thanksgiving. So I had this bright idea. I should start by being thankful, which I think in retrospect was a great idea. So I thanked God about everything that popped into my head, and I would thank God for what I read in the Bible on Elizabeth Street. And then I would turn the corner. Now I'm walking down Mill Street, which was the coolest part, and it was a rectangular block. So this is a longish kind of walk, all the way down to the mill pond where the old mill used to be. Does that matter? No. It's a nice place to walk would be the point. And as I walked along Mill Street, this is the second side of the block, I would pray for the people that I thought I should be praying for. Because I'd been a Christian long enough now to get into the cliche-ish kind of habit of saying to people, hey, I'll be praying for you. And I meant it. I meant to be that sort of person and knew that I hardly ever did as much praying as I claimed I was going to do. So here's a chance to sort of get that burden of guilt off my shoulders. I mean, I meant to be a person who actually did pray for my friends and loved ones, and I didn't do it much. But now I started to do it much on Mill Street. But the difficulty is I had a long list of people that I had offered this service to. So I needed to get further organized. So what I did was divided the work week, Monday to Friday, into five lists of people to pray for. I came up with a formula. And on Mondays on Mill Street, I prayed for my family, my parents and my two brothers and my two sisters. And as they got married, I prayed for their spouses, and prayed for my family. Often on the weekend, I'd got some fast-breaking news story from my family through phone calls. And so I'd have stuff to pray about my family on Mondays. That worked out quite well. On Tuesdays, when I turned the corner onto Mill Street, I prayed for my friends. Most of these were my friends from university who are now scattered throughout Canada and North America. I prayed for them as I would often have said I would. Now I actually did. On Wednesdays, I prayed for the people who I was doing Christian work with. So I prayed for my church, and I prayed for the camp, the Christian camp that Deb and I were volunteering at. I did that on Wednesdays. And then on Thursdays, I prayed for the people I worked with. I was working at a publishing company and, you know, trying to be a good example to them and a good friend to them and not a nuisance to them. So I prayed for them on Thursdays. And then on Fridays, because we are told to, I prayed for political leaders. It says in 1 Timothy chapter 2 that we should pray for those who are in civil authority over us. So I did that on Fridays. And I don't want you to assume too much about me at this point in my life. The political leaders of Canada in 1977 and 78 continued to go largely unprayed for. Because in actual fact, I didn't do very many Fridays. I meant to go Monday to Friday. I took the philosophical viewpoint that if I was hitting more than I was missing, then I would call it a successful week, which meant if I did 3 out of 5, I'd feel good about that, not bad about that. But Fridays were often a day that didn't happen, maybe just from the tiredness of the week. By Friday, I more regularly than not slept in and failed to do this thing. Shame on me. No wonder Canada got into such political difficulties. But let that go. So on the Mill Street passage of the walk, I did this praying for people, and then I turned the corner. But I should just say, that half, especially that street, was a real source of joy to me in retrospect, because it was something I believed I should be doing that I wasn't doing. And then I started doing it, and I felt good about that. It was a satisfying sort of thing. But I turned the corner. Now I'm on the third side of the rectangular block, and on the third side, I would pray about the day ahead. Fact of the matter is, I was married as I was, and I was working where I was, and we were in the apartment where we were, because the whole year before that, my fourth year of university, I had started trying to live out of Proverbs 16, which says, commit your works to the Lord and your plans will be established. I did that through the whole fourth year, because we entered fourth year, Deb and me, wanting to get married and wanting to get a whole lot of stuff worked out. I had very, very little of it worked out at the beginning of the year, and I started committing my works to the Lord in fourth year, and by the end of the fourth year, everything had come together. So I was on this roll about committing my works to the Lord. So on the third leg of the block, I would pray about that day, everything I knew coming up in that day. And this was a really helpful thing, to go into the day having talked to God about the stuff that I knew was coming up. I did that on the third side of the block. And then I turned the corner and went to the fourth side of the block. And so as not to be a guy sort of rigidly clamped down by some sort of detailed plan, I always left the fourth side of the block to pray freestyle, just to pray as I felt like praying. And in a way, that was the part that I really walked with God, because I was just really just walking down the street back to my apartment with a whole day ahead of me, having said my prayers, so to speak, and having done my Bible reading, and now I'm just free for the remaining 10 minutes of the walk to just talk to God. And that was a very satisfying experience. And in a way, was the essence of the thing, where I was just in communion with God, I'm talking to God. I may have continued from the third side to just talk about the day, or I may be talking about the future, which was a big issue to me at the time. But it was a really happy thing. And then I get to my apartment and I get on with showering and cleaning up and getting ready for the day, and off I went. And I did that, actually. I started that as soon as I discovered that I would fall asleep otherwise early in the morning. And I did that for exactly 2 years. And that's significant to me that I stopped 2 years later in October 1979. And the reason I stopped is we moved from Richmond Hill. And the reason we moved from Richmond Hill is that in those 2 years, stuff started to happen in regard to our volunteer involvement at this camp. And in October 1979, we sold all our furniture and let go of our apartment and moved to that camp that we had been volunteering at. And that was our entrance into Christian ministry, which led to our entrance into church work, which led to our moving to London and, in fact, our life work. So those 2 years sit in my mind as a really significant time of decision making and foundation laying and sorting priorities and other issues out. And I would look back on it now and say a whole lot of its success had to do with the clarity of mind and the strength of faith that came from literally walking with God every morning. So my suggestion to you is look outside your door and think about where you would walk for however long you want to put into the daily routine of talking to God. Find yourself a 10-minute walk or a 20-minute walk or a 30-minute walk. I wouldn't advise you to do any more than that. Like, don't start big. Plan big, but start small. Think about a reasonable-sized little walk and imagine yourself for many of the days of 2010 walking with God literally so as to assist you in walking with God figuratively through the year. Whatever else I can say about those walks, I never once fell asleep out there on the streets. Stayed awake, and I stayed on task, and it was a beautiful thing. So then let me talk to you further about the benefits. Speaking generally, the benefits of walking with God. And this is not an exhaustive list at all. This is just three things to whet your appetite about what 2010 could be like if one way or the other you build successfully into your daily routine some pattern of actually specifically praying in the ways that you believe you should be praying. This is really a matter of training in godliness. And what are the benefits of walking with God? Well, what are the benefits of training in godliness? Paul, writing to Timothy again, says in verse 7 of chapter 4, train yourself. Train yourself for godliness. For while bodily training is of some value, godliness is of value in every way, as it holds promise for the present life and also for the life to come. Paul says to Timothy, the saying is trustworthy and deserving of full acceptance. Here's something that Paul the Apostle believes deserves full acceptance, that godliness is of value in every way. So what are the benefits of this discipline? If it accomplishes godliness in your life, the benefits are many. And I'll list you three. These are not in order of significance at all. they're sort of in opposite order in terms of small things to big things. But here are three great benefits of putting in place a discipline that tends you towards Godwardness or godliness. For example, what prayer walking can do for you. So on the one hand, here's one benefit. Benefit A is simply the delight of a duty fulfilled. Now, you have to grant me my premises here. I'm talking as a person who really did see the value of praying for my friends and loved ones, really did mean it when I said, hey, I'll pray for you. And I wanted to do that, and often never got around to it. And now I was getting around to it, and it felt good to be doing something I believed I should be doing. There was a delight in it, because it was a duty that I had taken on and not fulfilled very well until this point, and now I was fulfilling it. So there's a benefit. The delight of a duty fulfilled, by no means the most significant thing, but it was a nice thing. And I found, you know, from then on, there was a real delight, a real pleasure in saying to people, hey, I'll pray for you, knowing that I actually would. And sometimes I would say, on Tuesdays, walking down Mill Street, I knew I would be praying for my friends. I could say that with some assurance. It felt good. But there's bigger things to get to than that, and here's one. So, benefit B. Let me say it this way, the pleasure of knowing God on earth. There's a whole lot of ways in which I could have identified this pleasure. I'll use these words and tell you why later. But what I'm talking about is the benefit of getting more personal in your relationship with God. So that God no longer seems, as he should perhaps seem to us, very far away, but starts to feel very close to us. Our relationship with God can become much more personal than it is, and this is one of the ways to make it more personal. I was in part inspired by David in the Psalms as I read the Psalms and saw how personal his relationship to God is. For example, as he conveys in Psalm 18, look at the use of the word my in this quotation. He says, I love you, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer. And now he's on a roll. My God, my rock in whom I take refuge. My shield, and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. I call upon the Lord who's worthy to be praised, and I'm saved from my enemies. Why did David use the word my so often? I think just because of the pleasure of knowing God. It gave him pleasure to think about all the ways in which God was a personal God to him, his strength and his rock and his fortress and so on. And we read in Psalm 42, though it's not written by David, the same Spirit written by someone else, he says, the Psalm 42 says, as a deer pants for flowing streams, so pants my soul for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God? Here's the soul thirsting. Here's the heart longing of a godly man who's developed a taste for God. And God is an acquired taste. He had developed a taste for God so that he panted for God like a deer pants for flowing streams while living in that part of the world. He had a thirst for God. He had the pleasure of knowing God on earth that caused him to long for God. And in those days, I was also inspired by more recent examples than David in the Old Testament. A role model and a hero to me in those days was a dead guy named Jim Elliot, but he hadn't been dead for very long. He died in 1956 as a missionary to the natives of the jungles of Ecuador. Perhaps you know the story from a book called The Shadow of the Almighty. Well, his journals were published, and in the January 16th, 1951 entry to the journals of Jim Elliot, as published in a book by the same name, he says, I walked out to the hill just now. This is Jim Elliot's journal, so written 5 years before he died, so he was 24 years old and was determined to live for Christ, and he had a hill. He walked out to his hill just now, and I admire that. Everyone should have a hill. When I was getting to know our new youth pastor, Graham Buchanan, just getting to know him, we're chatting around, he was telling me about some experience in his past ministry in Burlington, and I asked him how he handled something, and he said, well, I went out to my cliff and just dealt with that. Your cliff? You have a cliff? And he talked about living, you know, near the escarpment, and there's this place that he used to go to just be alone with God. He had a cliff that he sat on, looking out over whatever was below it. And I knew I was going to get along with this guy because he was that sort of person. He had his own cliff. Well, Jim Elliot had his own hill, and he went out to the hill. And why did he go out? Well, this is the point. Here's the rest of the entry. From January 16, 1951, this 24-year-old with 5 years left to live, he says, "I walked out to the hill just now. It is exalting, delicious, the wind tugging at your coattail and the heavens hailing your heart to gaze and glory and to give oneself again to God. What more could a man ask?" Now, he wasn't expecting this ever to be published. He's just speaking to himself. He says, "Oh, the fullness, pleasure, sheer excitement of knowing God on earth." I read those words and I thought, yeah, I think I know what he's talking about. And if I don't, I want to. I want to be that man. And I was, catching on to the pleasure of what he refers to as knowing God on earth. And he who at 24 knew a lot more about it than I did talked about it as a fullness, as a pleasure, as sheer excitement. And all that awaits us if we take the time to develop a Godwardness, a godliness, which we can do by devoting time, wide awake time, to prayer and to hearing from God. So that's a benefit, the pleasure of knowing God on earth. And here's a third one, to make a list of three, by no means the only three, but here's a third one. The personal experience of being helped by God. Now, the idea of God as helper is such a stunning thing, but so familiar that it is well worth thinking through more clearly. God, the God of the universe, signing on as your helper, when the word helper usually means a subordinate, assistant kind of person, but it's there throughout the Bible. Think of Psalm 46, the Lord is our refuge and strength, a very present help in time of trouble. God signs on as a very present help. Think of the hymn, "O God, our help in ages past." And it seems to me that this is one of the cases that James is making when he says, we have not because we ask not. We don't have as much help from God as we could because we don't ask for it enough. But if we got more consistent in our talking to God, we would probably be asking for more help. And his help is available. And his help comes particularly in one way. So let me get to the point of the personal experience of being helped by God. I'm thinking about Paul the Apostle writing to the Christians in Ephesus. And in that letter, we call Ephesians, he talks about his three specific prayer requests for the Ephesians, and he lists the three in chapter 1, and then he repeats one of the three in chapter 3, which makes me think it's his main thing. So here's his main thing. Here's Ephesians chapter 1. Paul, writing a letter to the Christians in Ephesus, he says, "For this reason, because I've heard of your faith in the Lord Jesus and your love toward all the saints, I do not cease to give thanks for you, remembering you in my prayers." He says, I'm praying for you all the time on Tuesdays on Mill Street. "That you may know, and of the three things, here's the third, that you may know what is the immeasurable greatness of his power toward us who believe, according to the working of his great might that he worked in Christ when he raised him from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly places." Now let me isolate verse 19. Here's one of the three requests, which he repeats in different words in chapter 3. Ephesians 1:19 says that he's praying that they would know the exceeding greatness of his power to us who are believing, according to the working of the power of his might. That's a mouthful. Ephesians chapter 1 is a famous chapter of a mouthful. Paul's style tends towards piling terms upon terms, synonyms upon synonyms, to try to emphasize a simple but profound point. And the profound point here is that there's such a thing as experiencing the power of God. And I'm thinking that the personal experience of being helped by God almost always has everything to do with being empowered by God, being given strength by God. And it's significant to me that Paul was praying for these Ephesian Christians, that they would know how great is the power. It's the same power which was used to raise Jesus from the dead, which Paul was praying they would know. And of course he would mean to know experientially. And look at how he writes about it. We can translate it, the words differently, and where it says exceeding, understand he means overarching or transcending, the transcending greatness of God's, well, the Greek word he uses, let's flip the slide here, the exceeding greatness of his dynamis. That's a Greek word. I'm just giving you the Greek word with a badly pronounced attempt at the Greek. It's obviously the word from which we get our word dynamite. And this is how he refers to what is translated as power. It's a word that means, well, power. And then he says, according to the, and the next Greek word is energeion, from which we obviously get our word energy, which is like power. And then he talks about this energy, this working of the power of his might, or of, well, you can interchange those words. The word might is used there. It's really another way of saying power. And it's the power of his strength, which is really his power. So in actual fact, what you can talk about here is that what Paul is praying that they would come to know, do the next slide, is the transcending greatness of his power toward us who believe, that corresponds to the power of the power of his power. What's Paul trying to say? He's trying to say, I really am praying that you will know the power of God. Which is to say, that God is quite prepared and able to be a help to you, and he will help you by giving you the power you need for the life that you need to live. Now, we see 2010 through a glass darkly, right? We know what to call it, 2010. We have expectations for it, January, quickly followed by February, and so on. But there's only a certain number of things in 2010 we know about, but some of them you are clear about. These would be the things that you carry forward as a burden. But think about how the power of God, can you think about how the power of God will change your ability to cope with the burdens you carry into the year? Some of you have significant health challenges. But if God's power is available to you, well, that will make a happy difference, right? To help you with your health challenges. And some of you have financial challenges. God's power can greatly improve your ability to have a happy new year while burdened financially. And some of you have relationship challenges. God's power is available to help you be the person you especially need to be because of the nature of the relationship which you would consider to be one of the burdens of your life. And some of you have career challenges of various sorts that you can see from the distance of 2009 looking at the extent of 2010. And God can help you. He can empower you in regard to the challenges that your career presents. And some of you have challenges in regard to the ways in which you are serving God. You could call them ministry challenges. But what would God's power do? Well, in every case, this is the help that God is able to supply. And James, the matter-of-fact New Testament writer, says to us, we have not because we ask not. He said just like that, speaking Greek. We have not because we ask not. Crazy people. Come on. Ask. So I'm imagining in the year 2010 that we get organized and disciplined in this aspect of godliness and start much more specifically and clearly asking God for his power, that we would by experience know his power, the greatness, the transcending greatness of his power toward us who believe. The same power with which he raised Christ from the dead is available to raise us up from our circumstances. This power that corresponds to the power of his power, is available to us, and we can know it by experience if we ask for it. And we can be much more at the end of next year like the Apostle Paul than we are at the end of this year. The Apostle Paul, who said, matter-of-factly, in regard to his great challenges, I can do it. I can do all the things God has called me to do. I can do all things through him who empowers me, strengthens me. And this would be the difference, I hope, for us as a church and as individual men and women who mean to take seriously the call of God that's upon us through faith in Christ, that we would be powerful people with the power that God supplies, the power of God's strength. And maybe, God willing, a year from now, we will all have stories to tell of the difference that the power of God has made to us as we got to know it by experience more thoroughly than we knew it going into 2010. This would be a fine thing. This would change a lot of things for us and for the people whose lives are impacted by our lives. So let's pray and ask God to make it so.